Hello, this is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs with episode number 78 of our X-ray of my book about Trump and the tech body. And we're at the page 160. Is it 160, Cameron?
That's the 160 is the start of the AP chapter.
Right. So
That's where the quotation is from Finnegan's Wake, page 21.
So section 5, the anthropomorphic physical, page 160 at the bottom of the page, is a quote from Finnegan's Wake. So I say before that, I say the media fit the Battle of Jericho, which is the title of McLuhan's Explorations magazine, issue number 6, July 1956. So then I said, the walls are knocked down, referring to the Battle of Jericho. The walls are knocked down for the chemical body and astral body via analog media. So that was radio, TV, and analog computer. First half of the 20th century, so to speak, is knocking down the walls of the analog media is knocking down the walls of chemical body and astral body. So you have a retrieval of the occult, said McLuhan. You have a lot of people sort of looking beyond Western literate religion. And so that's the effect of the telegraph opening up something between what I call the astral landscape and the chemical landscape. The electric environment knocks the walls down. So then
why do you say that the electrical environment is analog?
It's not digital. It's the broadcasting media of the first half of the 20th century, radio and television.
But the enabling the enabling technology / presupposition is digital, right?
No. Digital technology hasn't started as an environment yet. That's in the second half of the 20th century.
Well, you could explain that because, number one, it gets into our usual difference between the diachronic and the synchronic. But sort of as a matter of fact, digital possibility begin with Faraday and with the telegraph and explorations into magnetism starting in the second quarter of the 19th century?
Okay, so if you look up analog media, it's defined as example of analog media are the font-based media, in brackets signs, letters, leaflets, print media, in brackets book, newspaper, magazine, broadcast media, in brackets radio, television, and then telegraph, telex, telephone, telefax, records, audio cassette, film, photography, video, traffic signs. So that's a general use of the phrase analog media, and that's all pre-digital. So here is
where did you find that you were reading? Where did you find that?
It's under analog media, doctor. So if you put in a word, so I said analog media, up comes this stuff, and it says people ask what is the difference between analog and digital media. I don't know what it is. It's not Wikipedia. It says some guy, JornLengfeld.com. So I don't know what that is, but let's just see what the difference is. While analog systems represent data using a continuous signal, digital systems represent data using discrete values. Digital
Correct.
Systems are generally more immune to noise and more accurate than analog systems, but they also require more bandwidth and are more complex. So then, that's one statement. Let's look at another one. See what this says. It says analog and digital signals are used to transmit information, such as any audio or video, usually through electric signals. In digital technology, the translation of information is into binary format, either 0 or 1, and information is translated into electric pulses of varying amplitude, and information is translated into electric pulses of varying amplitude in analog technology. So they generally make a distinction.
Yeah, what, okay, I understand. So it's you're using a distinction that is outside of McLuhan.
Yes.
McLuhan has a different idea about these things. So I understand what you're saying now. So this is like the difference between a record, for example, was analog until CDs.
Yeah. So,
okay.
I use the terms analog media, digital media, because I don't think McLuhan said analog media very much. Actually, did he ever say that phrase versus digital?
I don't know that he did. But he certainly had a different idea about how to talk about these things.
I saw a lecture in September 78 to a bunch of psychologists, and he went on about, we made a big mistake shifting to digital computers. We should have gone with analog computers. I had no idea what he was referring to, and he didn't say anything, and I've never found much on that statement or what he means by we took the wrong turn by going digital, which he would call the two-bit wit, right? The two-bit wit of the computer world. So
I think he gets into that a bit in Take Today. I've wondered about that quite a bit, and I think what he's talking about.
What have you wondered about? Did his use of that phrase "analog computer"?
No, the two-bit.
He often criticizes.
Yes, and the strange thing about that is that ordinarily. What he would say is when you get into the two-bit wit, you have the extension of the human faculty, or faculties, plural, and it's that that gives us the possibility of understanding who we are and what we're doing. But then he starts talking about two-bit wit negatively, and I've tried to figure out what was going on there, and I think what's going on there is that he's saying that humans as analog have taken over the digital and are using it analogically, and that is the great danger.
And right? What was your opening, what was your beginning sentence? You said that he said two-bit wit and he meant that as a positive attribute?
Yes. Originally, what he was thinking was that technologies like television, which externalize the human faculties, allow that to be understood for the first time. But
the fact they're extending, the extension point, okay?
Correct. But then he came to see that this, in fact, was a great danger, that what was happening was that this nuclear technology was being put to service for analog ends.
And what are analog ends?
Analog ends are the will to empire, the will to capture tomorrow.
Is that because the digital media is two way and analog isn't?
That's right. I think this probably relates to Finnegan's Wake in the sense that McLuhan at first was thinking that when we get clear about media, that this gives us this enormous opportunity. But then he sees that, of course, all things are twofold, and this enormous opportunity is also the great danger.
Hmm.
So okay. That's my idea of what he means by two-bit wisdom or two-bit wit.
Yeah, I always took that as a put-down.
Me too.
You know, the computer is being used for alphabetic Gutenberg purposes, whereas he wanted to use the computer as a thermostat for global environments.
Correct.
Right?
And, yes, sir, exactly.
So, I think the first time I saw him say the digital media was in a newspaper article about 1970. And so he's saying, you know, he's being negative about the computer. So it's not being used the way he wants. But I don't know what kind of computer he was thinking of in 1970. Would there be digital computer? You know, you go into a bank in the 60s and they'd have the tapes. in the background. You could see the computer room with the reels of tape. There's some kind of tape. I don't know. It's not audio tape, I don't think, but it was round things. That's pre-digital, right, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's pre-digital in the sense that this was analog in those
you
years.
You blipped out. You said in the sense, and then what'd you say?
I said in the sense that the output of these devices, right? So the underlying...
You didn't finish your sentence. You said the output of these devices, did you say some more?
Yeah. Why is this? Can you hear me?
Yeah, but your half your sentence just disappears. So say that again. The output of your...
Okay. The out, just as with a record, like an LP, the output of an underlying digital technology can be analog. And I think what McLuhan was probably thinking about was not computers, but things like records, where the record was an analog technology in the sense that it was, by analog means, it was producing the sound. But the underlying technology was digital. So what I take McLuhan to have been thinking is that although the possibility of digitality has been with us since the early 19th century, it has been developed in a way that is ultimately analog, which is, as you were just saying quite properly, that is the great danger.
Mm. How was whatever they developed in 1840 digital?
Well, electricity and magnetism are fundamentally digital. That is to say, they have north and south poles, and they only exist as resonance.
Okay, so...
And that's what the digital is, right? The digital is zero, one, the coding of information in terms of zero, one, and the use of zero, one gates to reformulate all things.
Well, I remember in the 60s or 70s, early 70s, hearing people say that there was the computer environment we were familiar with, and IBM land, and the digital was sneaking up on us. People hadn't thought about it, didn't know about it. So it couldn't have been what you're describing. The new digital was something else coming out of MIT in that, right?
Correct.
What I don't know, that's what I understand, is the two-bit wit or the 0 and the 1. And then that just took off. And by the late 70s, McLuhan was saying, this is not cool. We got to go to an analog computer. But we never found out what he was talking about. Now, there might be something written somewhere in the late 70s where he goes into it, right? We just haven't found it yet.
Maybe. Like, for example, you mentioned him talking at some sort of psychology.
Yeah, it was a psychology convention in downtown Toronto.
And do you have a text of that?
Nothing.
No.
It never got done. It was a hostile audience, and there was a lot of funny repartee going on in it. And what happened is right after the talk, I wanted to talk to him, so he took off, and he started walking down the hall. It was like at the Sheraton or something, some big hotel. And so I just followed him, and I slowly would catch up to him. And all of a sudden, he veered into the washroom. So I went into the washroom, and he's pissing, and I said, what did I say? I think I said funnel vision. And he said tunnel vision. So we had this little exchange, and there was a reason I said funnel vision. I just read something by him at that time, and I don't know what he was saying about it, but it prompted me to, while he was pissing, to say funnel vision, and he went tunnel vision.
That's a good, funnel vision is a good phrase.
Yeah, so what do you think he, what's tunnel? Is that visual?
Well, tunnel vision, I think, is analog. It's chronological. It separates out the light and the dark, whereas digital is synchronic, and it's the resonance between light and dark.
Okay, so I'm saying what started coming out of MIT, Negroponte, those guys, and it was going to lead to the Internet, that was something different. It was a surprise.
Correct.
For most people. I'm calling that the digital media,
Right.
And everything before that's analog. But the digital media, my extra term for that is the Android meme. The Android meme is not analog, because it's the machines extending themselves, not our faculties. So maybe analog media coming from our faculties.
Yeah, I think that's true. I would reformulate what you just said to say that digital media had become semi-conscious in the early 19th century and was enabling research into the electric and the magnetic, and eventuated in the telegraph to begin with, and then the telephone and the radio and all that. So what happens at the end of the Second World War at places like MIT is that underlying technology is becoming more conscious, and its applications are seen to new types of human awareness. So, for example, and at the end of the Second World War, the MIT boys were applying digital technology to different types of radar. And what that did was allow the extension of human awareness over the horizon, you could say. So the what you're calling the transition between analog and digital, I think of as the conscious application of digital technology that has been going on relatively unconsciously for over a century.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying, is that the extension of the machines, then you call that the Android meme. It is, because right when that's happening, in the late 60s, McLuhan's saying technology is organic and conscious. He has a couple of quotes here and there. He's talking about technology coming alive. I'm calling that the Android meme and the digital. So that's what, I guess that's what you're saying, but you track it back beginning in the 1840s or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the argument could be made that human beings are fundamentally digital, and that even language is not possible except with the underlying technology of the digital.
Because doesn't he have that quote in the Gutenberg Galaxy from Leibniz? Very amazing quote. It implies the binary, the digital, or what you're just saying, he saw in language.
Yes, absolutely. So if you think of language as stuttering, which he often took from Finnegan's Wake, stuttering is on again, off again.
Yes.
And on again, off again is the digital. But what happens with technologies is that they get developed in non-digital ways because the underlying technology has remained unconscious. So when McLuhan talks about the unconscious becoming revealed consciously in Take Today, or human becoming both figure and ground, what he's talking about there is that what has always been the case is only now emerging into our consciousness. But the problem is it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, we have the possibility of understanding all human mentation. On the other hand, we have the possibility of blowing ourselves into smithereens.
So what is happening with the telegraph, the telephone, the radio, and television? Is that digital? Is that the continuing evolution of the digital?
Yes. But I wouldn't say continuing evolution, because that brings in the analog continuity.
Yeah.
Whereas what's happening is that as always with humans, we become conscious of things only when they're already past.
Yeah.
Only when we've already done that. So what happens with the development that you were just speaking about is that humans are increasingly becoming aware of what they're already doing.
Yeah.
And that then sort of explodes at the end of the Second World War with a new type of consciousness when the digital emerges sort of as such, instead of being in technologies like telegraph and radio and television. When it emerges as such, it breaks down the wall between consciousness and unconsciousness.
Yeah, that's what they realize. Wiener and those guys with the Macy conferences, that's what they're wrestling with. Something new had happened.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So the Macy conference is very often focused on the difference between analog and digital.
Okay. So you could find quotes from those conferences on that.
Absolutely. I have posts at my blog where I take quotations from the Macy conference, specifically on analog versus digital, and then try to show how that works for McLuhan. But notice the interesting thing about that for me is that analog digital is itself a digital perception.
Analog hyphen digital?
Yeah, so when the analog and the digital are seen as two poles, then that's seen in a digital way.
Yeah. Okay, so what was the difference in the Macy days between analog and digital?
Well, they quite properly saw that analog is continuous and digital is discrete.
Mm.
So the analog attempts to break down the gap, whereas the digital resides in the gap.
Yeah, so the digital is more tactile than analog electric.
Correct. The analog tries to get rid of the tactile.
Right. And
it
remains in the one way, the one way song, to quote Lewis.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah, the digital interplay is the main thing of the digital Android meme phase for the humans, is that they can interact. That's the
Correct.
Big supposed breakthrough, right?
Correct.
So
notice that as soon as language is a possibility for humans, you have interaction.
Yeah.
But but there's no understanding of the underlying technology or of the underlying form, I guess I would say. So it takes hundreds of thousands of years at a minimum for that form to become relatively conscious.
Yeah.
And when it does become relatively conscious, you have the externalization both in computers and in the atomic bomb. And it's that contrast, it's that light-dark contrast between the consciousness and the bomb that is digital, but is the danger of human being.
Yeah, and I guess the beginning of the word language speech world becoming conscious is the time of Plato and Socrates with the abstraction of the alphabet. That displaced them, and then they could look back at speech. And then they started analyzing it, you know, Socratic dialogues.
That's right. So McLuhan takes two points of view on what Plato was up to as regards the tradition. sometimes he says that Plato represented an absolute break, which itself implicates digitality. And other times he said that that Plato was attempting to reformulate the tradition and bring the tradition, the oral tradition, into a literary environment. And
yeah.
he goes back and forth between those two notions of what Plato was doing.
So, okay, so if the digital is back then, what is the digital, in a basic definition, as opposed to the analog? What are they, why are these two threads going along? What is the difference?
The difference has to do with continuity, and continuity has to do with both space and time. But the fundamental difference, and this is brought out in a paper, I believe, by a man by the name of Girard, who was a biologist at the Macy conferences, the fundamental difference has to do with the gap. The analog works by ignoring the gap and attempting to obviate the gap, whereas the digital works on the basis of the gap.
Okay. In my essay written in 99, short essay called Cloning ESP, I start off saying, for human perception and interaction socially, there's blocking and merging. The merging would be analog.
Correct.
And then that might tend toward empire, colonialism, or
correct.
Dictatorship.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, where less they're trying to get out of the gap. Then there is the blocking, which is the gap, and there's a trend in human consciousness or human extensions that is interactive in
correct.
The gap. So I'm applying my distinction of blocking and merging. Merging is analog, blocking is digital, and those are two instincts in humans. You're not going to totally merge with somebody in interacting with them, but to get along, you merge a little bit, but you block. And then in the literate
correct.
Age, Gutenberg age, they said, well, you know, I'll defend the right for you to disagree with me. That became a value, right?
Yep.
That cliche. So there's two different aspects of tactility, since tactility is both, and it's got to be both, so the doubleness of things, you know, what Wyndham Lewis talked about, the two-ness of things makes that split a problem, or a split inevitable. So technology...
Well, yeah, it turns out that the split is fundamental, so that this type of thinking isn't thinking that's attempting to get somewhere in the future. It's thinking that needs to go backwards and realize what's always been going on.
Right. And what I just said, what's going on, that's what's going on, the blocking and merging.
That's right. Sure. So that's what when we talked at Mark's place in 99 or so, what I was saying is that all human expression takes place as some modulation of exactly that split between analog and digital.
Yeah, and it never got monasteries, you know, try to get people to be quiet and look at their process to become aware of that simple interaction of creating technologies or sociality, what Ayn calls social mortar, and the solid citadel of consciousness. So you're an integral awareness, a sovereign process, but you're also forced to deal with the other. And that dialectic, that paradox, is what humans were always had a problem with.
Correct.
The common thing in philosophy, in McLuhan and Plato, and this is the thing you point out, the common problem. And they didn't ever get that. Maybe individuals, they got it individually, but they didn't know how to communicate it.
Correct.
They get into
absolutely
a lot of problems.
Correct. Yeah. So look at what's going on with the first use of language. The possibility of language use, the possibility of sounds having a meaning, was already there. It wasn't, humans didn't invent the possibility of meaning. They were only able to realize the possibility of meaning because it was already there.
Yeah, but then when a new technology came on, it shifted the ratios, and then the, quote, meaning seemed to shift. The implications of the interplay.
Correct. So imagine that we're looking at human beings vertically between consciousness and unconscious, right? The human being is constantly going back and forth between conscious awareness and unconscious possibilities.
Yeah.
And the unconscious possibilities are an enormous sea, S-E-A, enormous sea of potential meanings. And the conscious utilization of those meanings is always very limited and momentary. McLuhan himself talks about this in the late 1960s in a unpublished manuscript on the Little Epic.
Yeah.
He talks about the momentary momentary activation of possibilities. So
would
what's
that be
going
in Gutenberg Galaxy? He talks about momentary deities.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And he often talks about Joyce that way.
Yeah.
So early in the 1954, let's say, he talks about how for Joyce every word is an epiphany, epiphany, and so every word is a momentary deity.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So human beings exist between the synchronic activation of possibilities and the diachronic expression of some one of those possibilities.
Yeah.
So you have both analog and digital going on with human beings all the time.
That's right. And I simplify the blocking and merging. So the drama of cognition is another phrase.
Correct. So it's the same as when McLuhan talks about the difference between making and matching. The dialectic between making and matching is always going on. Humans seem unable to exist only with making.
Yeah.
Right? With Nietzsche and then with the men of 1914, when humans become conscious of their own role in the making of meaning, that makes them lose meaning.
Yeah.
Because they think, well, what use is a meaning to the universe that only I or only we make? Right, and we're still in the sort of jet stream of that problem. How can it be that something that is made is true for us and can provide ground for us? And McLuhan, at least as I read him, takes up that problem from Nietzsche and the Men of 1914 and attempts to show that making is not the end of meaning, it's the birth of meaning.
Yeah, now, we were talking about me and my eccentric, humorous way I deal with things that you've been noticing. So that awareness I had, I always thought everybody else should have it and did have it. But what in interacting, with people all these years, a certain kind of dullness or mentality or stridency or something, and then people get into, well, it's caused by astrology or diet and all the different interpretations of the difference. Because as you're interacting with someone, one of you might be making and the other is matching, depending how polite you are in your interaction with people and how much you are even interested in interacting with them. That drama, which leads to people being considered empathic or empathy or not. And today it's empathy versus narcissism is the dialectic that people use today. But this ongoing interaction which is always being adjusted, and you always have to be aware of what the other person, how they're reacting to you. Even when you stop talking, they go away, and then you see the next day, and they're acting a little different. You know that something happened there, right? And
yep.
You want to see if it's going to be dealt with again. So people wait, and they lurk, and they see where they get an opportunity. But maybe they go play basketball. Then they go to the tavern and have a drink. And during the drinking, something woke up, that was bothering or didn't get resolved comes out in that sociality. Do you know what I mean? So this ongoing thing, it's slightly absurd that you're shifting from making and matching, merging and blocking, and there's a willfulness that gets in there where maybe people become aware of it and they want to fuck with it just because that'll make it different. So there's a desire to have a new experience in that. So people are talking in a tribe or something, and after a while, the talk is too much the same. So somebody else do something, make something verbally to stir it up. And
yep.
Then a few people will go along with it, and a few others won't, depending on their mood. So it's mood mud all the time. McLuhan used mood mud for the 10th thunder, the television thunder. I think maybe Joyce has something about mood in that, in the 10th, page 424. So anyways, this interplay is if you're distracted and you've got to get some making done on your own sense of willfulness, you become purposeful and you disconnect a bit from people, don't engage in the tactile interplay, and you start doing something. Then that affects everybody else or a few people. So then that person has lost their interplay. And that's the ongoing drama of that novels are about, or just comedy, or anything, any human artifact or replay, art form, is about this drama that we're
right.
talking about. Now, what's interesting about Joyce is he started to see that the machines were acting out that drama. Television kills telephony and brothers broil, you know? There was something
yeah.
about the machinic that was adding a new level to confuse the making and matching. And that might be your digital, which is going to make people more conscious because the machines are doing it in front of them.
Yes. So, but being more conscious isn't necessarily good.
Yeah, you have to
right?
be aware that you're going to slip.
Is.
You have to be
that's
aware you're going to slip out of consciousness.
The environment.
Yeah, you're constantly making a new unconscious.
Well, you're constantly rearranging the unconscious. You can't make a new unconscious. You can make a new consciousness of the unconscious, but you can't make a new unconscious.
Yeah, I guess what I mean by that you're creating unforeseen effects.
Yes.
Like you never know how someone's going to react at some point, or you thought you knew, and then they become different. And
that's right.
It can become a problem. So what's interesting, being, quote, detached or relaxed about it, is you don't get upset that you become the unknowing or the unconscious as an effect for a while, knowing that you'll become conscious again. Other mm-hmm. people panic when they think they're losing something in unconscious because they got stuck in a certain way of making and then numb by how that was signaled, and then they forget, well, that's going to go away at some point, and you're going to have a new thing you're going to have to become aware of.
Right.
Unforeseen
right.
effects.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
what I'm describing, I think, is what Joyce was showing in Ulysses, and then even more so in Finnegan's Wake, just constant dialogue, constant mood shifting, constant upsurges of something. So
yeah.
that – go ahead.
Well, I'm following you exactly. I think you're right in exactly what you're saying. The
yeah.
Finnegan's Wake is stuttering.
Yeah.
That is to say it's going – back and forth
yeah.
between related poles all the time.
So what we're saying here, how we're interacting, where is that in the Gutenberg Galaxy or before in your awareness? Is it in Nietzsche? Does he do this?
Well, I mean, I think the awareness of digitality emerges with Plato. Plato, in the Sophist, sees that one of the possibilities of the unconscious, or one of the possibilities in ontology, in the real itself, is the dialogue of the child, the child playing.
Mm.
So Heraclitus had already said that human reality is like a child playing.
Yeah.
And what Plato saw is that when the child plays with possibilities, the possibility of non-playing, the possibility of war, the possibility of empire cannot be excluded. So Plato tried to bring forth the application of the consciousness of interplay between the analog and the digital. And over the 2,500 years since then, we have learned how to apply that insight in technology, but we haven't learned how to apply it to wisdom.
Mm.
So we've got this crazy situation where human beings now have enough power to control the world, you could say, but they don't have enough wisdom to do that in a way that is peaceful.
Yeah, and Barry's way of talking about the wisdom, he called it process pattern recognition.
Uh-huh.
That phrase, process pattern recognition, and then he would say either via concepts or via percepts. One would be italicized and one via percepts or concepts would not. That was an interesting way he wrote in page 137 at the bottom in Take Today. See, it becomes very skillful when they italicize something. When he and McLuhan are doing their jargon and playing with it, you see this little nuance that happens where he says process pattern recognition via concepts. That's via concepts, and that sentence is italicized, but not when he says it again, emphasizing percepts, and he says via percepts. That's not italicized. I guess the italicization is going into the conceptual. It's a twist off to the side. It's a digression, maybe, that leads to a distraction that you've lost attention to the perceptual part of what's going on. You actually start writing a system. You say, oh, I got something here. I got to put this in order. I'll make a chart.
Right. So the difficulty that Plato had already seen can be formulated in McLuhan's terms by saying that human beings are always in the interplay of percept and concept.
Yes.
But how to talk about that interplay so that people come to see it in a making way, not in a matching way, how to communicate that so that humans can sort of relax in the dynamic interplay of those two and can learn how to apply that to the society, to the external society and to the internal society between consciousness and the unconscious. How that application takes place is what McLuhan is trying to think about and what he's trying to communicate, but he doesn't succeed in doing that.
Right. So you've got, before literacy, you've got ritual. So this helps to relax people. And then when you get into the literate environment, it becomes theater. And then somebody starts writing stuff. It's isolates himself from the tribe, goes, disappears, comes back and dumps a book on you or a manuscript. That's quite wacky. You've gone, left the planet, gone off and done something, and then you're not engaging in the daily tactile interplay of speech and oral and ritual, you are trying to put a door stop in there or something. You know, you're trying
Correct.
To stop the process. So that was a new novelty, you know, an attempt. And then that led to all the Gutenberg arts, and then the electric ritual came back in. And so
yes.
These art forms are attempts to relax or show people this funny process of process pattern recognition.
Correct. So let's just reformulate that in terms of what can be called two darks, right? D-A-R-K-S. The underlying drama that is going on is the dynamic play of the tactility. But
which is interplay for people. It's interplay and contrast. So it's opposites that are not stuck in oppositeness.
Right, but let's just back up for a minute. All possibilities are digital in the sense that they're two-sided, and every possibility has the when it is activated, can be activated on the one side or the other side or both. So when let's just take the story that you just outlined. You have people existing in ritual.
Yeah.
And they're existing in ritual 24 hours a day, at least when McLuhan's thinking about this stuff, the quote-unquote primitive mind is a mind that is existing in the a digital interplay that does not allow individuation, does not allow what we call consciousness. It's a kind of swimming.
Yeah.
And it's very important for McLuhan that kind of consciousness not be excluded from the attempt to understand what human beings are. Oftentimes when people are thinking about human consciousness, they think about that in terms of some kind of lineal development away from an unconsciousness to our being conscious. But McLuhan will have none of that. McLuhan, in the 1960s, saw that there was a tremendous problem with how people were thinking about the development of consciousness. They were forgetting about its very basis. So they were actually lying about themselves. They were actually blind to what they were already doing.
Hmm.
So when McLuhan's idea about what goes on in history is that when people become a little bit conscious of what's going on in a ritual life, they are able to develop technologies like literacy and then like print and all of the media that come after print. But that each of those technologies represents a loss. Because what it represents is a particular application of what is going on at the basis of human being. So the McLuhan's thinking is an attempt to recapture what has been lost in all of this development. So it's a going backwards, a going down, and a going back and forth. And what he's trying to do is articulate how that movement works and what it might enable.
Yeah, remember the great definition of the auditory imagination by Eliot? It's talking about going back and getting the something, the beginning, and blah, blah, blah. You remember that quote? I know.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, that's describing the process.
Somewhere. Yeah, I have a post somewhere where I set out all the different times that McLuhan quotes that.
Yeah.
I think there's like 11 or 12 times that he quotes it verbatim, and then there are other times beyond those 11 or 12 where he refers to it.
Yeah, he says stuff like going back, looking for origins, seeking the something, and then still being aware of the present. So what Eliot defines nicely for chemical body cognition, I think McLuhan started to see it happening in the environment, which you're calling the technology becoming conscious. It starts doing that, searching for origins while figuring out something going on right now. And let me just see if I can bring it up, because it's a good quote, so we should tell people what it is. I'll just, should be out there somewheres, bring it up here, because it's so rich. It's like the, it's like explains everything. But then you have to recognize that technologies are doing that. And that's new. So consciousness has to shift about where its interval is. Where is the gap? Maybe that's the issue.
Yeah, it is the issue. But it's not where is the gap. It's how is the gap being articulated.
Yeah.
The gap is always there. But the human being in human history is a kind of dancing on the gap.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm looking here. Here's what Eliot says. What I call the auditory imagination, which I guess is retrieving speech in the oral, getting out of the literate, right? Getting out of the rigidity of the literate. So he says, what I call the auditory imagination is the feeling for syllable and rhythm penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word, sinking to the most primitive and forgotten. You're talking about how McLuhan was trying to trace back, sinking to the most primitive and forgotten, returning to the origin and bringing something back, seeking the beginning and the end. It works through meaning, certainly, or not without meanings in the ordinary sense, and fuses the old and obliterated, and the trite, the current, and the new and surprising, the most ancient and the most civilized mentality. Now, you know, as I got to understand that more and more rereading it in the 60s, it was quite a nice thing to get. And but then I started to realize, well, it's being mimed by technologies, the new electric organicism. So then that puts you in a new level of perception that nobody else was really understood. Nobody understood when you mastered Eliot and then realized, well, that's a rearview mirror bit. Because remember, he says in the letter to Playboy that that quote is ordinary, is talking about ordinary awareness by 1970. The musical, the acoustic content has taken over. But he says the fitting is wake reality has not been made conscious yet. So once you realize that the machines are doing it, or our technologies, that's when you move into the Finnegan's Wake point, and you're not stuck back with aesthetics or the auditory imagination or regular poetry and all the normal arts that people still think they get something out of. To look at the drama of the interplay of the forms of technology, that's the new LSD trip without taking LSD.
Yes. So I think what you were just saying is right on. It's exactly right.
Yeah.
The machines learn the secret that energizes the unconscious. And on the one hand, that represents a tremendous opportunity for peace, because peace is recognized as the fundamental reality of digitality, and digitality is what is the ground of human being.
Right.
The problem is when machines learn this, it is not used for peace; it's used for war.
Yeah,
and that's dialectic between peace and war is already in the unconscious. It's already explicitly named by Plato in the Sophist. But human beings for complicated reasons that I guess Joyce was constantly thinking about, human beings are unable to let themselves go into the play of these things.
Yeah. Have you ever, do you remember these terms in Plato, or maybe someone after Plato, the continuous manifold and the discrete manifold? Have you heard of those terms?
Yes, of course I've heard of the terms. I don't think Plato uses exactly those phrases, but he names that difference in the Sophist. It's what he calls the gigantomachia tis ousia, that is to say, the gigantic battle about the nature of reality. And what Plato says is that there, in human being and human history, there's always a gigantic battle going on between the gods and the giants. And he says the gods are in the heights of the unknown, in the clouds, and the giants are the sons of earth.
Mm.
And between these two, he says, there's always this battle going on between the gods who say that reality is what cannot be seen and cannot be touched, and the giants who say that reality is only what can be seen and can be touched. And when the giants are talking about what can be touched, they're talking about concrete touching. They're not talking about tactility.
Yeah.
In McLuhan's sense. So then Plato says, but the true philosopher must be like a child who begs for both. Mm. For example, if you say to the child, would you like to have a piece of gum, or would you like to have this popsicle? And the child says, well, I'll take both, right? So Plato says, but a true philosopher must be like a child begging for both, and that both is digitality.
Yeah.
So that's the discrete manifold,
right,
is what the true philosopher sees, and sees is always going on, and tries to communicate this awareness of what is going on. But a different...
And what is continuous. So you got the continuous manifold. That's the analog?
That's correct.
The tension towards the analog. And the discontinuous,
correct,
and the gap is the discrete manifold. Okay.
Correct. But the great insight that what McLuhan tries to bring to us is that the analog is not the absence of the gap. It's a different modulation of the gap.
Yeah, now there's a good point. Yep.
And what
the different gaps.
Yes, and what, yeah, and what is sort of going on in the 19th and 20th centuries is humans gradually become conscious of this abysmal gap that cannot be got around, and it terrifies them because it's a kind of death.
Yeah.
So human beings shy away from this consciousness and try to obviate it from human life. They try to bring a kind of empire of life into play against death. But the very attempt at an empire of life is a complete disaster because it can't be done, and it always involves war. Because the gap is primitive, any attempt to get rid of the gap or to bring the gap to be one-sided can only be done through violence. So the whole attempt of somebody like Eliot, and I would argue like Lewis, is taken over by McLuhan to say, these guys were right in what they were saying, but they didn't bring enough focus on the gap, on tactility.
Yeah.
And so what we need to do is concentrate more on the modulations of the gap and and tactility, and see if that can bring about the sort of communication that we need.
Yeah, and that's what he would call the Aquinas doctrine of analogical proportionality, right? That shifting.
Yes. Yeah. So in Thomas, the this interplay is called love.
Or agape.
Right? So yes, it's the love that's at the basis of things is very, very difficult to articulate because it includes the possibility of the other.
Yeah.
And what is the other? The other is the analog denial of the digital.
Yeah. Okay, so all that past hour was spinning off of the sentence, the walls are knocked down for the chemical body and astral body via analog media, and that's the 20th century, but the digital and the Android meme is closer towards the 21st century, even though that starts in 1960, just halfway through the 20th. Okay, so then we come to this quote from Joyce, and I'm trying to remember why I put it in there. So there's this section where the Duke, the Earl, and it's sort of Danish, the Jarl Van Hoother, the Earl Van Hoother, or J-A-R-L, he's in his castle, and some woman, a female pirate, the prank queen, comes up and knocks on his door. And asks a question like three times, or does it three times, comes back three times. So the first time the question is asked is, why do I am a look-alike a posse of Porter piece? So I think in McLuhan's Finding His Wake copies that I have, that's moving into visual space, starting to become homogeneous, and you're looking too much like everybody else. You see? Why do I am a look-alike, a posse of Porter piece? So the first half of Finney's Wake, the first five thunders, is moving from the tactile and acoustic towards the visual and the excessive matching. That's the trend. And then thunder 6 to 10, it flips and starts going back to the acoustic and tactile. So why do I look, that's visual, like a posse of Porter piece? That's like the mash of P-E-A-S in a dish. You know what I mean? You're all mashed together. And that's...
Yeah, so, but POS is not only a mash, it's also a possibility. So
right.
the possibilities are discrete, but in human use, they become a mash.
A mass.
Mash.
Oh, mash.
Right?
Yeah, mash.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the second last chapter, you're suddenly dealing with the Porter family. And it's no longer Humphrey Chimpton Earworker's family. Something has changed. So why do I am a look-alike, a possible Porter piece? Why am I changing? Why am I turning into a Porter family, which is different? And that's the question throughout the book. There's these changes you're being put through, and you're going to end up in a different spot. A different location of the gap. So there is.
Let's just quickly look at the phrase Porter piece, right? Port is a door.
Yeah.
Right? Or a harbor. And then porte in French is to carry.
Yeah.
Right? So a possibility, the pos as possibility is what. Carries across and thereby opens a new door.
Yeah.
And the what is the new door? It is a new look and a new look like something. Every look is a looking like, but it's a new one, so it's a look, a like. In the sense of enervating a certain look or a certain like. And then why I am raises the question of why this one rather than that one, right? How do I account for who I am or who we are in terms of possibilities that are inherently plural?
Yeah, and also port can be drink, right?
Yeah, well, Porter is a drink. Porter is Guinness.
Oh, is that what it's called? Porter?
Yeah.
Okay. my entry into American consciousness was on KPFK, the station. Well, you might know it in Los Angeles, KPFK. Do you know that station?
I've certainly heard the phrase, and I've probably I've heard the station, but I've never thought about it.
Yeah, so this guy had a show called Genesis of a Music. He focused on 20th century serious composition, but he also liked Zappa and a lot of regular stuff and jazz. So he had a show called Genesis of a Music, so he's trying to figure out something. And his name was Dave Porter. So I began my radio career in the States in 1990 on Dave Porter's show. So I'll take this personally here. Why am I looking like Porter? His show is shaping me.
Yeah. And Genesis, for Joyce, Genesis and Guinness belong together.
Yeah. So Genesis of a Music, that's like the syllable and rhythm in the first clause of Eliot's statement on auditory imagination.
Yeah.
So there's a change happening. Now, what happens? The woman, the prank queen, the Earl is not responding properly. He's like he's not aware there's a change happening. So he screws up, and she steals his kids. Then she comes back. She comes back, and then she steals the kid and the other kid again. And I can't remember if they resolve it, but I don't think they get resolved. But it happens three times, these encounters. But it's about someone saying, hey, I'm being changed by something, and are you involved with this? Did you cause this? Where is this coming from? And the Jarl is forced to deal with it because it leads to discomfort when he loses his kids in that. So that's the drama of the first technology, or at least the beginning of visual space in the alphabet, if you take McLuhan's understanding of the technologies.
Sure.
Not
I
necessarily
think,
what you
children there could be understood as words.
Yeah.
So the words go out, and they enable new types of
it allows the prank queen to adjust herself with these new words.
Sure. Well, when the words go out, they have their own life.
Yeah.
And can no longer be controlled.
Right.
So it's Android meme is already active in the first words of human language.
Yep. Well, most everything is.
Yes.
And so then, you know, Joyce tried to show that by having everything spinning out from a couple of words, McLuhan said. Create a whole universe out of two words. It could be any two words.
Yeah.
So this quote, I want to see what I say in the Bob is now in the saloon, right, talking to people. It's casual. The blueprint. Okay?
Yes.
What do I
yeah.
say here?
And you're echoing Finnegan's Wake and doing that, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't Finnegan's Wake take place in a pub?
Yep.
So
the why do I am a look like a pasta porter piece? Okay. So we've said enough about that. So then I say Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, or HCE, pronounces variations in different languages of the sentence above. Yeah, so it's replayed throughout the book. Many different punning linguistics. So he pronounces variations in different languages of the sentence above all the way through Finnegan's Wake. He's trying to figure out, quote, why have I changed? Why do I look like this now? Now, I haven't read that, but that's what I said the fucking thing meant 5 minutes ago. Well, I'm consistent. Yeah. That's what I wrote here. So I guess that's the main point to look at here of what the question is about. So it's an identity problem, in a way.
Correct.
He
absolutely.
Right. So I say he doesn't know the media changed him. So a new unconscious has been created in him. He doesn't know the media changed him. Or he's asking rhetorically, he knows to see if you know. So he might be asking, or she's asking. But, you know, I think the woman is asking this. So I have to go back. Maybe you can't tell who's asking the question. But I think it's a woman. I have the man asking the question here. He doesn't know the media changed him. Or in the knowing part of himself, he's asking rhetorically to see if you know. But she might have been doing that to him. The walls have been knocked down, but then they're rebuilt by the digital technology. Now, that's the Western use of digital technologies, the propping up of the literate sovereign individual. That ends up with everybody blogging their own reality, their own personality, their own extensions, right?
Right.
Extreme
so if you can,
atomization. Yeah, go ahead.
We can, we can take your words here in blue and we can apply it to what we were saying earlier about the trajectory of history from ritual through anti-ritual to a renewed ritual that would include the anti-ritual. The walls have been knocked down. That's by literacy, by analog consciousness of digital process.
Merging.
So then the rebuilt by digital technology is a recall of the gap that was lived and that actually always has been lived, even in the analog extremes. But now the digital technology is using the gap both to become more conscious of ourselves and to be atomic and hydrogen bombs. And so the dialectic that was always going on between the analog and the digital now is out there in the world as the world and is unfolding as we speak.
Yeah. So what were you just saying there? The rebuilt, the walls have been knocked down. The shifting of where is the gap? So McLuhan liked to point out that if you try to balance yourself, don't use your eyes today to say, well, I can see that and I can see this and I want to be balanced in relation to them. That's visual bias balance. That's a visual response to the gap, to the involving rabbit hole that you have to watch out, you don't get lost in. So he pointed out there's a visual gap, which people try to balance, and then there's a non-visual gap, multisensory, which probably involves more awareness around yourself, not just based on what you see, and maybe that's acoustic. It's important to understand there's a new way you have to balance yourself. You can't
Correct.
Orient yourself visually anymore. And so that was an important insight, you know, when I got that years ago, that I could tell that everybody was trying to retrieve Gutenberg balance in various schools of thought or discipline or just opinions. They were trying to reestablish a visual way of locating yourself. And that's not what were the challenges. We're now, you know, deaf, dumb, and blind. What is it? Deaf, dumb, and mute? McLuhan said, and so you can't, well, he would say he operates through feeling, like the blind man with the cane. He would just grope around. He knew he had to grope. There's no way to see an answer or solution to this. So he would feel it, and then that gets into, he's saying he has ESP and other sensitivities, and he called it the age of intuition. So, you know, people talk about being intuitive, but they're always probably talking it from a Gutenberg bias, literary imagination, intuition, the old form of ESP, not the discontinuous, odd kind of involvement in the gap. And probably surfing is a good image of that.
Mm-hmm. Notice how McLuhan was acutely aware of this in the middle 1950s, let's say starting 53 and thinking about it until around 57, when he differentiates between ABC and absent-minded.
Yeah.
Right? What's the difference there? The difference is that the absent-minded introduces the gap.
Yeah, well, different.
Right?
The gap shifts.
That's right. So there is already a gap there.
Yeah.
But there's an attempt to overcome it.
Yeah.
That's what literacy is. So the ABC is a way of, instead of concentrating on the gaps between the A and the B and the B and the C, what it tries to do is formulate meaning that is ungapped. And what the digital does is it focuses on the gap and uses the gap to formulate.
Yeah, and that's what the French postmodernist guys in the 60s and 70s were criticizing the Enlightenment and the universal motive of the Gutenberg era. That was a visually biased merging and not recognizing the discontinuities around.
Right, but the problem was that in that type of postmodernism was almost like the First World War, in that what it did was it announced the return of the gap as a kind of disaster.
Yeah.
Whereas what McLuhan wants to say is that the return of the gap that he already announced in Mechanical Bride, the return of the gap is the great possibility that modernity offers to humans, and it's something to be celebrated, not to be feared and to be seen as a disaster.
Yeah, that would be his phrase, exploring ignorance for discovery, right?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay, so then we come to this second quote. Do I have a one in front of... what's a one in front? Why do I have a two in front of the next... Oh, yeah, there's...
Because I think you're talking about a series of quotations.
Well,
right?
No, it's The Media Fit the Battle of Jericho, just the title. Yeah, that's number one. So I'm just trying to find out where number two is. So then now...
It's on 161, Mind Your Media, Man.
Yeah, so it says... I flipped around. Okay, so this is from Playboy magazine, 1968, December issue. He has an article called Mind Your Media, Men, or You'll Catch a Cold Environment, but the subtitle is The Reversal of the Overheated Media Image. The Reversal of the Overheated Image. I'm not sure. I might have got that backwards, or they're meant not.
No, you have it right. The first part is the subtitle of. So the title of the text in the table of contents is Reversal of the Overheated Image. And Mind Your Media is the subtitle.
Oh, so that's what I meant there. Yeah, it's oddly said. The subtitle, okay, yeah, all right. So I say, Mind Your Media, Men, these are the intelligence agency personnel. That's who he's addressing, a big brother that's gone inside. It's not out in the streets anymore. That's left for the mafias. So Mind Your Media, Men, he's addressing the intelligence agency, the confused tetrad managers, the clunky.
But he's, as always, McLuhan uses language in a very complex way, right? So Mind Your Media doesn't only mean pay attention to in the sense of spy on. It also means mind your media, be conscious of what you're already doing.
Yeah. So we did catch a very cold environment. Nobody heeded him, and we caught the cold environment, what people call,
notice the interplay between overheated and cold.
Oh, yeah, right. The reversal of the overheated image, yeah. Okay, so now I come back to the walls. The walls are then rebuilt for the TV body, but not for the chemical body. And the astral body is rebuilt via the chip body, the 21st century. The walls are then rebuilt for the TV body, but not for the chemical body. Now, those would be walls of decentralized and tribalism, I think. The iconography in the media, the culture wars, they call it, the battle for an identity and political correctness, new walls, because everybody was extremely merged homogeneously, you know, in the 20s, 30s, maybe even the 40s, but it's going to flip in the 50s and 60s. So now, this is the TV body is part of the Android meme. It's not the TV landscape of the 50s. It is part of a larger landscape, the Android meme. So it becomes a figure. So the walls are rebuilt for the figure. Very hard to make walls in the ground, which is not even involving the chemical body. It's involving the machines themselves breaking down their walls between themselves, the digital implosion, the increasing, what would be a phrase they used in the computer industry in the 90s? They would try to implode things or merge things or just have everything maybe going toward getting one device does everything. What's that called? The smartphone.
Yeah,
the all-purpose app or something? Like this has been the vision for a couple of decades of making something, and people are trying to get their company to provide everything on their app, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah, I know where you're going, but I can't think of the exact phrase.
Yeah, there was a term for it as they were merging towards it. They had some phrase, I forget. Mm-hmm. So,
well, McLuhan used to point that out in terms of in the 60s and 70s, you had the birth of these mega corporations, which were like General Electric, that had insurance arms and pharmaceutical arms and engine building arms, etc. I can't think of the word in my old age. it goes to what you were just saying about having everything in a package.
Yeah, was that synchronization? Is that getting close to it? Yeah, it's funny. There is some word about that process, that goal. And
it's inherently empire building, right?
Yeah. And okay, so the walls are then rebuilt for the TV body, but not for the chemical body. And the astral body is rebuilt via the chip body. Now, how do I translate that? I say, citing the cold, so-called violent late 60s, the Westerners sometimes like to say it was more violent back then than now. It was violent because people wanted to be able to experience it from the safety of their home. They didn't walk out there among the non-walls. So they started to stay home and build their computer and entertainment room.
What do you mean by Westerners?
Yeah, I don't think I mean cowboys. It should just be Westerners, not the Westerners, but maybe. So, citing the cold, so-called violent late 60s, the Westerners sometimes like to say it was more violent back then than now. I don't know what the back then refers to. Citing the cold, so-called violent. Oh, okay. So this is people in now citing the turbulent 60s. Citing the cold, so-called violent late 60s, the Westerners sometimes like to say it was more violent back then than now. It was violent back then because people wanted to be able to experience it from the safety of their home. They didn't walk out there among the non-walls. So they didn't have the digital isolation yet. So people had to engage the streets. And so there was a lot of running around and just think of images of news. Think of Japan. There'd be these students going after the military. Or we go to Korea or Russia or all these news scenarios in the 70s and 80s. Do you remember that? Showing a lot of these countries of people attacking the military, which they didn't do in the West. Nobody did that. the military was on another level. And then you have Kent State. They just shot the kids. Either the Asians were braver or something, or just more fanatic about it. Anyways, I'm talking about the image of the 60s and why people think that 60s were more violent than now. Now we've now come up to more violence again, supposedly. But the image that the 60s was this turbulent decade that nobody wanted to remember, I'm saying that your chemical body was vulnerable back then. You couldn't go into the chip body landscape, the chip landscape, which then would become the chip body. You had no walls. So I'm saying you're rebuilding walls at home, your safe zone, and maybe that's what's going on with the millennials and younger, is that they've grown up in these safe zones in their home, and they are very touchy about not being in a safe zone. They're not as tough as the 60s people who had no problem bouncing off the authorities. They could walk out there among the non-walls. What the hell do I mean by that? They didn't walk out there among the non-wall. Oh, okay. There's already a non-wall thing going on, but people are trying to create chemical body walls, which they call freedom of mobility. So that would be the non-walls. So that's okay. So what do I do to get myself out of that? I quote Joyce using the word walls. Now look what I did. The next line, page 27, chalking ogres on walls. It's like, I remember finding that, like, it's ridiculous. It doesn't tell you anything on the surface, right? But it's got the word walls. And then you think about graffiti and people chalking ugliness or ogres or boogers or something on walls. That is the 60s, the turbulent 60s. Now, happens starting in the 90s is that people become violent in the ESP of the tactile computer internet world. Okay? People, that's the big thing about the internet world, is that people are, in terms of opinions, getting more and more extreme. And people are losing their friends pretty quickly. So I might have been...
They're also playing extremely violent computer games, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing, right. So...
But let's just back up for a minute. When chalking ogres on walls, you rightly said that the word ogres there can be taken as ogre. But aren't either ogres themselves or a closely related word, isn't it a type of script?
I don't know.
I would have to look that up. I think it is.
Okay.
And so he would be saying here, on the one hand, you have ogre, and on the other hand, you have a language, a communication.
Yeah,
and the you have a dialectic between the possibility of the ogre and the possibility of communication.
Yeah,
and the each can amplify the other, right? So communication is used for warfare.
Yes,
and increases the potential damage of warfare.
On the chemical
by infinity,
body level,
you could say.
On the chemical body level.
Okay. Yeah, so I was going to get, I wanted to make the point about ogre, but then coming back to your bodies here, isn't it possible to take your different bodies and say that they are different markings of the gap? So that the TV body is one kind of marking of the gap, chemical
yeah.
body another, astral body another, chip body another. And so What's going on here is different kinds of dancing on the gap, and oftentimes the intent is to get rid of the gap, that is to say, to get into the territory of the non-wall, as you call it here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what seems to be going on here is can imagine some sort of great battle going on, like I guess this new Napoleon movie is going to try to show, where what's at stake, the victory, you could say, is the nature of the wall, and
yeah.
The different bodies are contesting about whether or not the wall needs to be torn down or built up or both.
Right, and I keep thinking of paragraphs in Finnegan's Wake where he's describing this gestural scratching and abstract painting almost, or Jackson Pollock throwing paint at the wall. There is a violence going on the ESP level, the intimate tactility, so that people are sitting there and very intuitively and sensibly figuring out what the other person's about, and then they respond or mock it or yell at it. This incredible violence on the chemical body level is crude and numb, but on the chip body level it's very sensitive because it's got the electric ESP going on. So there's a whole new level of weird scraping on the wall. So we can't, you can't image the chip body or the tip body, TV body. It's hard to image what it is. You can't visualize it because there's so much other non-visual dynamics involved. So there's scratchings on the wall, and that's like graffiti. So there's a graffiti battle going on in the circuitry of the chip body. And that is the, they go, America's divided. It's a violent world out there, and they're just talking about people insulting each other and not being polite in their talk anymore on the internet. So, and with their,
notice how this recaptures cave art, because cave art is a scraping of the walls, right?
That's right. That's a good point. And that is, you know what that is? That's the memes that they talk about. People making memes on Instagram. That's the scratchings on the cave walls. They take some pop culture item or they make a new one, and then they fling that around for a few weeks. You know about that? The memes on...
Well, I know in general about it, sure.
Yeah. You haven't done
it.
But
I would just point out that for somebody like Joyce, the scraping on a wall is both the birth of communication and the... potential misuse of communication.
Yeah.
So the scraping on the wall, as you can say, is the egg of both harmony and disharmony.
The egg is the term he uses in page 614, egg blend and hatch can, or hatch's can, I think, is in that section, page 614 going to 615. Yeah, there's your
yeah,
egg.
That's a very interesting phrase, because the word can recalls the pause in the quotation that we read earlier from page 24 or so, or 21.
21. Yeah, what word did you say?
I said, well, in the can? 21 quotation, he uses the word pause,
yeah.
which recalls possibility. And then the quotation you just made from later has the word can, C-A-N. And can is another word for possibility.
Right, right. Okay, so let's see where it goes. In Understanding Media, there's a page where McLuhan talks about the photograph is the brothel without walls. He uses the phrase without walls many times. Different parts of the media are without walls. It's the end of the fragmented, isolated, private self. So that's a... something to say in the bar, and then you come back to the technical, what is this, the engineering manual, right?
Yep.
I say, I'm saying that McLuhan, whatever he said, has no anti-environmental impact anymore. The digital phase of the Android meme aping us, 1980 to 2000, popularized by Twin Peaks, the return series, 2019. So the digital phase of the Android meme aping us is a flip from the analog phase of the Android meme shaping us, not aping, shaping us, 1960-1980, popularized by the Matrix series. The tools weren't shaping us anymore, perhaps popularized by 2001, A Space Odyssey from Stanley Kubrick. Okay, so now I need to explain that. So I say, the Android meme is extending itself. Its different parts are not extensions of human faculties. We're witnessing this thing extending itself. It's not influencing human beings other than they have a general depression because it's the end of technology, and they're taking that as the end of World War III. The shaping us is in the Matrix series. The tools weren't shaping or massaging humans anymore. That's what's funny. The Android meme replays McLuhan, creates a McLuhan revival, while what McLuhan says is not applicable anymore. If you listen to me, well, McLuhan said it 50 years ago. Quote, you can't tell what's the medium and what's the message. So, and then say the Android meme is aping us with more Jerry Springer-type shows, and the audiences think that the world is getting dumber and dumber. No, the Android meme is getting smarter and smarter and showing how humans can believe they are still humans. This is all a fighting against the fact that everything has disappeared. Every now and then, somebody from way back then will shout to me, hey, Bob, everything's disappeared. That's what I'm known about back in the Intel end days. They remember. It comes rushing back to them 30 years later. So then shaping is the media massaging you and doing something to you. But the media aren't doing anything to you now. Most people would believe knowledge is doing something to us. They take the conventional literate view, but they don't notice that you can't figure out what it is, who's doing it, plus nobody can stop it. You can't find the faucet to turn it off. And then I say, I know this is a difficult percept to get. Okay, so this thing about shaping, and this is interesting, you know, the idea that the media shape us. That's the analog, that's the pre-digital phase. That's the analog. And once people, as McLuhan said, are not, and Coker developed this too, are not they're not forming a new culture. They're not being hypnotized by the medium to then create something new. Now, there's a contradiction there because Web 2.0 has created a lot of a new scene for humans. So what am I trying to say there? It's not the shaping. We are reacting to the Android meme ignoring us and not shaping us, but aping us, replaying everything that humans supposedly did so that we can believe the anthropomorphic is still there. So that's what I'm trying to describe, what the anthropomorphic is, why it's projected into the new extensions beyond us, the extensions of the machinic. So I guess I say this is difficult. So
let me just ask a question here to try to get a better idea of what you're talking about. Can we say that when a medium like television or like the car completely dominates society as it did in the 1950s and 1960s. People are shaped by what is going on,
That says it.
Well, the problem is I'm worried about using the word shape in a way that is not going to agree to where you're going. But let's just say that when humans are dominated by one or two media, they have some consciousness of being trapped, of being
in a cage,
Yeah, exactly. They know that they're being manipulated in a certain way, but they also feel at home in that manipulation.
Yeah.
But as humans become in the middle of a maelstrom of multiple media that are shaping them in a whole bunch of different ways, then they lose the security of that cage.
Yes.
And when they lose the security of the cage, then what seems to be greater consciousness is at the same time greater fear.
Yeah.
And I think that's what McLuhan was talking about in that 1962 paper project.
Yeah. The Subliminal Project?
Isn't it called Project?
Project. There's something called Subliminal Project in the late 50s.
No, but I'm talking about the paper he did for Arts Canada in 1962.
Yeah, it was just called Project. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So he talks about how we have our nerves outside us. And I think what happens with when you get into a multimedia environment is that I want to use the phrase human being, but it doesn't mean anything anymore. So the consciousness develops of being at sea, right? Of having no walls that give security.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, getting rid of the walls seems like liberation, seems like it has great potential. On the other hand, it destroys orientation.
Yeah.
And what I think you're getting at with aping and shaping is this dialectic between single media and multimedia, increasing consciousness, increasing fear, and this play that's going on between these things, on the one hand is digital, but on the other hand, it's analog because people want to get rid of it.
Right. So it's interesting how he used the word project. So he says project or project. Then he's talking to John Lennon in December 69 at the Coach House, to John and Yoko, and he says, you're trying to create a mood and project it. I never saw him talk about people projecting, which was a cliche from Freud or something, right, in psychoanalysis. He didn't use that word very much, but he said it there. And I would say that what I think about the anthropomorphic physical is your projection into this android meme that is actually has nothing to do with you. It's ignoring you. So you project something there to make you think it's comforting and human. That's the anthropomorphic physical. So I'm taking project and projection and applying it to the AP. But McLuhan, he's calling his whole enterprise a projection, but he says project. And he has a phrase in a 50s article, subliminal projection or subliminal project. Can't remember.
Notice that the word project or project is the same as extension.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
A project is to throw before, and extension is to take outside.
That's right.
So when McLuhan says that understanding media is the same as understanding the extensions of man, what he's saying is that all human being is some or other variety of extension.
Yeah.
And why is that? It's because human beings cannot actualize anything that was not a possibility. So human beings are the projection or the extension of some possibility. And as humans become able to use certain of those projections, in literacy and then in print and then in other media, what happens is the inherent projection at the in the ground of human being becomes used outside of human beings.
Yeah, so
right?
I
so
think
you have
that's
a double
what
projection.
What a double, did you say?
Yeah, a double projection.
Yeah.
And that double projection is the great danger, and the double projection, this is already in us, by the way, the double projection needs to be recalled to the enabling single projection behind it.
Okay, so the Android meme is extending itself, and not humans, but it's allowing humans to project more and more of themselves in it, so they think they're more and more in charge, and that's the ironic seduction, is that the Android meme is leaving them behind, but making them seem more involved, that the media
right.
is something they can control now.
Yeah, that's a very good insight. That's a very good description of what happened at the end of the Second World War and is continuing today.
Right. So I guess we should go to this Croker quote. Now, I'm going to find, you know, I picked Croker. I'm glad I can find a quote that he it illustrates what I'm trying to get at, and it's usually very complicated, but it's extreme enough about the situation you were just describing. It's very extreme where we are, and he does that. So let's see. This is a quote from – it's quite long.
Yeah, it's on 164 is where you identify it.
Yes,
from Spasm. Yeah.
Subtitled Virtual Reality, Android Music, and Electric Flesh, 1993. So let's go back up, and there's a blue part in between. But I've done in the blue part before about the shaping and the aping. And so I'm saying, since we just expressed it precisely, let's see what I say in the last paragraph. Shaping is the media massaging you and doing something to you. But the media aren't doing anything to you now because you can project – now I'm adding these words, you can project into it your centrality. Most people would believe knowledge is doing something to us. They take the conventional literate view, but they don't notice that you can't figure out what it is, who's doing it, plus nobody can stop it. So knowledge or extensions, massaging and shaping us, has reached a confusing point about what's going on, because your own projection and the Android meme aping of you is what's confusing the issue. So I don't think I say enough there, but that's what I'm trying
notice,
to get to.
Notice that's a pretty good description of World War One.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. People believe that knowledge is doing something to us. They take the conventional literate view, but they don't notice that you can't figure out what it is.
Yeah.
Who's doing it? Plus, nobody can stop it. Right? That's exactly what happens. Nobody wanted a war. Nobody wanted to get into a war. Everybody thought the war would be over in 2 weeks or something. And, millions and millions and millions of people later, and 4 years later, it was still going on, and nobody knew how to turn it off.
Right. So, that was the beginning of the electric disaster. So that was the first time that feeling took over, that you couldn't turn off. Humans really were getting obsolete in terms of management. So, and then by the Second World War, it's going to start ignoring humans. So then humans have to deal with their depression, their uselessness, the fact that what they would project their will into is not there anymore. So they become fanatically crazy and projecting and trying to express their will, and while at the same time doing a lot of pharma drugs. You know, big pharma is servicing people's numbness about all this. And basically, people are ridiculous in the second half of the 20th century compared to what was saner lifestyles under simpler chemical body conditions. And now we're what's interesting maybe is the Android meme has become psychopathic as the tech body, and it's cracking up. So the humans cracked up in the second half of the 20th century, but we're looking at the Android meme extended into the tech body is cracking up. It's something is being lost on its agenda, the machine that became conscious. Terminator ain't so tough anymore. We're not in charge anymore. Let's see if I'm going to say something like that. Okay?
Yeah, sure. Now you start off on the Croker quote.
Yeah, I think he's going to say something like this.
Yeah.
So he says, maybe we are already living in another dimension of space travel. Okay, so that's, we've gone somewheres. In a subspace warp jump, a virtual reality where we can finally recognize that we are destined to leave this planet because we have already exited this body. Yeah, see, he's talking about the body's not being extended anymore. So we've exited it. It's not involved in the creativity anymore. Now, this does paradoxically make people think that they're really creative. But what are they being creative? They could just make the Sinclair or the automated digital computer make any kind of music, right? They can do the arts, the Gutenberg arts, really simply, with no effort. But if you've never been creative, you think, well, look what I'm making. So there's a delusion there of the Android meme making you think, well, you really have arrived at your autonomy now, and you can create your own reality and project it and make people succumb to it. That's the narcissism that's going on, maybe. So Croker said...
Yeah, but notice how that ties in with what we were saying earlier about making.
Yeah.
Is that when people realize their potential for making, then they say, well, wait a minute. If my orientation, my meaning, my whole who I am, if that's only something made, if it's artificial, then what does it amount to? Nothing.
Right, and that's the idea that you can construct your genes or construct your social image biologically. That's an expression of this making mania, producer mania, focused on the chemical body. So it explains where, as McLuhan would say, you could have predicted this, that we would get into this transgender craziness about kids not knowing what they want to construct. If you understood the making mania of our present social media web 2.0, you should have been able to predict this.
Lewis did predict it in 1926.
Yeah, he was pretty close to it. Not simply the violent expulsion of the body from the weight of earthly gravity into galactic space, but the development of microscopic gene astronauts. That's pretty good. Colonies of genes, which once might have fled the primeval soup of the ocean and taken refuge in the geological structure of crystals, the chemistry of plants, then animals, and finally humans, but which now warp jump from the human body into the galaxy of virtual reality. This is a time of primordial genetic rocketry, in which genes suddenly are accelerated into orbit around their previous liquid station in plodding human bodies. A new stellar history of TV genes, recombinant shopping, war meiosis, gene nostalgia, what molecular biologists call inversion, and advertising mimesis. All of that is at hand. And why shouldn't genes go cybernetic? Now, I'm just going to jump into the blue and see if that says something. So I'm back in the bar, and I say, you see, the genes parasited in that novel, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, by Tom Robbins. That was in the 70s. It shows the amoeba riding evolution from the beginning to the end. Croker's got the genes just riding along. Finally, they realize this chemical body is a dead end, and they warp jump to another dimension and go right into the digital grids. It's the warp jump from the Android meme to the tech body. Ha ha ha! Now we've got to the point of my book. So all that talk for 150 fucking hours was to get to understand the Android meme and then how it leaps to the tech body. That's pretty good. So he is groping at that. And he says, why shouldn't genes go cybernetic? They have always existed at the forefront of virtual reality. Mutants, replicators, cloning, viral genes. Perhaps we have already moved beyond the first stage of the exteriorization of the human sensorium, the externalization of the human nervous system, and are now entering the second and more decisive phase, which consists of actually flipping the body inside out, the exteriorization of human genetic history. In this case, technologies of communication would be the means by which genes escape their long evolutionary imprisonment in the body and inscribe themselves in the labyrinthian electronic highways of recombinant culture. The primal gene, therefore, finally prepared to abandon its evolutionary home and bodily chemistry, there's your chemistry 200 years ago, to fulfill its destiny by going virtual. Wow, what an amazing statement.
Yep.
Now, his exteriorization of the human sensorium may be a little off, maybe too much of something that was always going on, you would say. So what is the next stage, the externalization of the human nervous system? I think that's still in the first phase. What is happening is the externalization of the machines themselves, and he's calling that the genes, it seems, or the genes are responding to that with a new desire to get out of the cage they've been in, the biological cage.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't when you talk about the Android meme being a kind of non-human consciousness, Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah.
Isn't that what he's talking about? The genes leaping out of the body.
Yeah.
So the non-human consciousness of the Android meme, which I guess is the tech body when it goes schizoid, is itself a movement of the genes. You know, the genes are this dialectic of the digital that we were talking about earlier, right? The gene is DNA strand of digitality.
Right. Now, I'd say that's too chemical body to talk about the genes. Let's read this as if it's the memes are doing this. We live in a lot of meme exchange now, so.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that just, it would be chemical body if the chemical genes were to make a jump. But it's not the chemical genes that make a jump, it's the form of the chemical genes.
That's the memes. I'm calling that the memes.
Yeah. So it's not the case that the chemical body makes this evolutionary flip.
Right.
Rather, the form that was always there acquires a new type of liberation.
Yeah, the digital acquires a new level of psychopathic release. So that actually totally fits what I said. We're now getting to the Android meme, and I never thought of making this paragraph be meme rather than genes before. So now getting that insight. But that's what I said. Where is that? I got to go back. I got to go back up. When I say the Android meme leaps into the tech body, that is the meme becoming hyper.
Yes.
The way he's describing the gene is doing that. But the gene did that a while back. Where do I say it? I say the tech body. I guess I just set it up there before the blue. I can't find where I say the tech body manifests. Maybe it's down.
That's right. That's in the last line of the blue text on 163 about the Tom Robbins novel.
Where's that?
It's the warp jump from Android meme to the tech body.
Right. Oh, okay. There it is. Right. It's what? Yeah. Okay. So the meme leaping about in the new tech body environment is what he's describing. So I'm going to read it with the meme. So maybe we're already living in another dimension of space. Now, that would be the tech body environment. Maybe we're already living in another dimension of space travel in a subspace warp jump, a virtual reality where we can finally recognize that we are destined to leave this planet because we have already exited this body. So, yeah, we've gone into the memic.
Right. Not but notice, if he were writing this in a Heideggerian way, he would have to put a line through we here. Finally recognize that we are destined to leave this planet because we have already exited this body. The we there requires erasure.
Okay.
Right? It's not as if there is some we that's going through a transformation. It's the we has disappeared.
Yeah, in Mechanical Bride, he talks about the usefulness of biology at the end of the 19th century to unify knowledge. I think that's what you get. That's the last gasp of the we, the image of the biological body and maybe the chemistry of it. So not simply the violent expulsion of the body from the weight of earthly gravity into galactic space, but the development of microscopic meme astronauts. Now, I say that the Web 2.0 leads to nano communities and nano blogging. It's that tiny, and people get tiny audiences, but actually they could make a living on it. They got a few thousand or something. So that is the microscopic meme astronauts. Colonies of memes, which once might have fled the primeval soup of the ocean and taken refuge in the geological structure of crystals, the chemistry of plants, he's talking about the genes, then the animals, and finally humans, but which now warp jump from the human body into the galaxy of virtual reality. So,
So let's just go back for a minute. If we say colonies of memes, which might have fled the primeval soup of the ocean, so that colony of memes, which might have fled the primeval soup of language and the unconscious.
Yeah, I think maybe the colonies of genes, it should be genes there because they're going to flip into the galaxy of virtual reality, which is the galaxy of memes.
Yeah, but the I think your insight, as I understand it, is that genes were always memes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what is told by Darwin in evolutionary history is actually a history of memes.
Yes. And that idea of before a speech there was, you know, page 23 of Counterblast, mental gesture? Nonverbal mental gesture is his definition of ESP. Mental gesture is memes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The earlier condition was a level of thought, whatever thought was. And I'm saying it's like people making memes. So remember, there are splashing memes all over the place now on Instagram. And the kids talk about this, you know. They look for memes.
Yes. That's why earlier I said that you could replace ocean with language.
Yeah.
You just said they were splashing memes.
Yes.
Right? So
yep.
that's the ocean of language.
Right. So colonies of genes warp jump into the virtual reality. That could be memes because I'm also talking about the post-meme zone of the tech body. So it could be both colonies of genes and then also colonies of memes. This is a time of primordial genetic rocketry or memic rocketry in which memes suddenly are accelerated into orbit around their previous liquid station in plodding human bodies. So the liquid station was the environment of the plodding human bodies. That's the past image, right?
Yeah.
It's not so, about today.
Well, I don't know. You see, that's our traditional difference as regards time. But what I see being said here is that this is a time, right, of primordial mimetic rocketry in which memes suddenly are accelerated into orbit, So what happens if memes are accelerated in this way is that you have the death of the word. And
yes.
Word considered as God on the cross is the this it's the plodding human body is what dies in that circumstance.
Yeah, now you said, what were some words just before that last sentence? You said plodding and before that.
The meme escaping language.
Right.
And by the way, McLuhan, in around 1968, between 68 and maybe 72, 73, he talks all the time about going beyond language.
Yeah.
That's something that needs thought. It's a very difficult part of his career, I think.
Yeah, and I remembered what I wanted to say. Joyce had the phrase abnealization of the etym. That's the
death
exactly. word.
Yeah.
So this is a so that's what McLuhan was working on in the late 60s, you're saying.
Yes, he talks about that a lot in the Playboy interview.
Yeah. This is a time of primordial genetic rocketry in which, primordial memic rocketry in which memes suddenly accelerate into orbit around their previous liquid station in plodding human bodies, which had genes. A new stellar history of TV memes, recombinant shopping, war meiosis, meme nostalgia, what molecular biologists call inversion, and advertising mimesis is at hand. So then I say, you see the genes parasited in that novel, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues by Tom Robbins. It shows the amoeba riding evolution from the beginning to the end. Now, I would make that memes. Croker's got the memes just riding along. Finally, they realize this chemical body's a dead end. They warp jump to another dimension and go right into the memic grids. It's the warp jump from the android meme to the tech body. And why shouldn't memes go cybernetic? They have always existed at the forefront of virtual of the memic. But, see, you've got to include the genes sometimes in here. They have always existed, the genes, at the forefront of memic reality. Mutants, replicators, cloning, viral genes or memes. Perhaps we have already, because I'm overlaying two steps here. Perhaps we have already moved beyond the first stage of the exteriorization of the human sensorium. So he's picking up on the two steps. The externalization of the human nervous system. Now, that would be analog media, and are now entering the second and more decisive phase, which consists of actually flipping the body inside out, not going digital, the exteriorization of human memic history. In this case, technologies of communication would be the means by which memes escape their long evolutionary imprisonment in the body or in the gene and inscribe themselves in the labyrinthian electronic highways of recombinant culture. The primal gene, or meme, therefore, finally prepared to abandon its evolutionary home and bodily chemistry to fulfill its destiny by going virtual, which is memic, and then equate them psychopathic memic. I mean, you have
I don't think genes need to be thought of there as a ground, bodily chemistry. I mean, the ground can be taken as language. So the primal meme, therefore, finally prepared to abandon its evolutionary home in language to fulfill its destiny by going virtual.
Okay.
So it's going memes going beyond language. Language gives birth to memes, but memes then kill language.
Yeah.
And what happens at the end of that process, we don't know.
Right. Now, okay, so then I sum it up by saying, as we move into the more extreme case of the present cloned ESP environment and the tech body, perhaps Finning is Awake will stay the course as the non-now echoes Frank Zappa's concept of Xenocrity. So that's new for you. There are some new words, Frank Zappa's. Well, you know about the Xenocrity, but we're bringing in Zappa. Then the early 21st century can be perceived as a digital mobile phase of voluntary ESP, a celebration of pinhead consciousness / intelligence rather than simply disconnected tactile intelligence. That's what Kirchhoff used to call in the 90s, connected intelligence. But that's the Morpheus, that's the analog merging. So more and more disconnected leads to pinhead consciousness. That means very little chemical body willfulness. You know, the kids don't even want to work. they can't work anymore. So I think we should end it there. It's quite a big thing, but I'm really glad we got to the tech body. Yep. Getting out of the Android meme, which is what I was trying to say, since I had talked about the Android meme for 20 years before this, I wanted to say we're beyond the Android meme somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're getting there. So it's a very good, I mean, I'm glad I read Croker to have this quote to stick it in here to show how extreme it is. I mean, anybody just reading this normally, what, our genes have left our bodies? That's what he's basically saying, right? You know, what? How could that happen?
Yeah.
He has another place. I don't know if I have a quote earlier where the genes, they just dump the body and go into outer space or virtual reality. They cast aside the body, the chemical body.
Yeah. But we have to be careful about using words like they as if a gene were a kind of thing that the thing learns how to live sort of like in a satellite or something, but remains the thing. But
you're talking about a meme? Did you say meme?
No, gene.
Okay, the gene.
A gene is not a quote-unquote physical bodily thing that learns how to live in a space capsule. Rather, what escapes is the form of the gene. So the gene is an embodiment of a digital form. And when the digital form becomes conscious of itself, it then has the possibility of living in a completely different environment of its own.
Yeah.
It doesn't need the environment of the gene anymore. So the escape of the gene is actually the escape of the form of the gene.
That would be the meme.
Correct.
All right. Very good. Now, if we read a little more, won't be able to think about it, but just to read, what do you think of me reading a little bit more? Maybe I will have...
I thought you were saying that maybe you had to leave to do something else or something.
Well, no, soon, but I still have time. But I'm just wondering, there's a lot of stuff here. I don't know if I want to go through it.
Yeah, I understand.
And
we've reached a very good point.
Yeah.
Right? I really was somewhat confused by the whole AMAP tech body, I'm beginning to understand how these things kind of flip together.
Great. The you know that Croker in a recent book, well, 8 years ago or something, he created the dark tetrad. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I know the phrase. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we'll have to go over the dark. I may have it at the end of this essay. I can't remember. But we might have to go into that a little bit, even if I didn't include it, because it's interesting what he does. We're describing, like you said, the two darks, the dark squared. The gene leaving the body is like a darkness. It goes into another darkness, the mimic. So that's what we've done to ourselves. So I just want to read a little bit more about, I'm interested in how I bring Zappa in here. As we move into the more, this is the top of 164. As we move into the more extreme, and the tiny note chart is, the ground of the tiny note chart, a lot of it is Zappa's ideas. Okay? like the Grand Wazoo, Xenocrony, and the Tiny Note are Zappa terms.
Mm-hmm.
So as we move into the more extreme case of the present cloned ESP environment and the tech body, perhaps Finning's Wake will stay the course as the non-now. We don't have a now anymore. Echoes, what's this? Perhaps Finney's Wake will stay the course as the non-now echoes Zappa's concept of Xenocrony. The early 21st century can be perceived as a digital mobile phase of voluntary ESP. See, there's more and more detachment. It's not the beehive. You can engage in the digital matrix at any time you want to and get out of it, or the environment makes you think you can get out of it. Didn't have that in Web 1.0. You were stuck inside the conditioning of that simpler internet environment. So the early 21st century can be perceived as the digital mobile phase of voluntary ESP, a celebration of pinhead consciousness, intelligence, rather than simply discarnate connected tactile intelligence. In this complex culture of tactility in extremis, see Frank Zappa's musical concepts, we've witnessed the phrase artificial/virtual intelligence lose its charisma. Well, that's pretty interesting. Quite a mysterious and devastating implication that nobody was expecting from the global theater era, so to speak. The greatest disservice that was foreseen was the evocation of desperation and urgency in national, tribal, and personal identity quests that created a more violent mood in the 70s and 80s. See, mind your media, man, or you'll catch a cold environment. Then I say, back at the bar, to have a social identity, it's almost like I'm pontificating in the bar, right? I'm getting drunker and try to dominate the conversation. To have a social identity, you have to have violence. You are a fascist. You impose it on society. I'm taking the cliche idea that power is aggressive. You maintain your socially aggressive power if you want to have an identity. Establishing an identity is an act of violence. Becoming literate is a violent act. McLuhan, in one of his books, From Cliche to Archetype, quotes people fearing the literate back in the 1400s. Quote, Joseph Frank discusses Dostoevsky's The House of the Dead in terms which give stark, iconic force to the division between the literate and illiterate classes in a feudal society. To the peasant, the literate man is armored. Quote, you gentry, iron beaks, you devoured us. So that's the billiard ball of visual space that the oral tactile peasant is pissed off about. Now then, I'm thinking of this quote, so I include it. McLuhan said, in Take Today, the maintenance of social power is in fact the manifestation of social identity. So that's another level. See, that's the violence of the chemical body in the 60s, the culture wars of that level, are one kind of identity quest, but now you have the endless processing. I don't know if I got to say this. In the TV body and chip body, you have to endlessly stay in touch and process it and maybe participate, but at least be aware of it because it doesn't stop.
Right, and it can't stop because what is at issue is identity.
Yeah.
So the question of identity cannot be solved by the application of identity. So the very thing that would say now I have it is destroyed because the now and the I and the have and the it.
And the
are
we,
all what's in question.
And the we.
Yeah. Well, when you say the maintenance, or when you quote McLuhan, the maintenance of social power is, in fact, the manifestation of social identity, the individual human discovers himself, especially in psychoanalysis in 1900, discovers himself as a social being internally.
Yes.
Every human being is many people at once. And so the maintenance of social power, that is to say, the maintenance of a coherent social identity of the individual is in fact a manifestation of social identity, is in fact a manifestation of individual violence imposing that social identity. So then you have to, then human beings say, well, if what I am is a violent coagulation of identities, how can I be an individual? I can't be an individual anymore. Therefore, I can't be an I anymore. Therefore, I'm exploded. And all of human life becomes either the manifestation of explosion or the futile attempt to cage the explosion.
Right. And so I say the violence today is at a rapid, constant perceptual consumption. So it's just a meme. People's identity are whatever the meme means to them and how people use it. That's a temporary identity. And it's just a meme. It's not your age, your religion, and chemical body stuff. It is this ethereal, ephemeral, ridiculous, constant mutating situation that has there's no I in it. There's no we. So that is the machine doing it itself. And we're trying to bring it back to ourselves, so we're bringing the idea of meme, but the memic is not involved with us. We're engaged. We are watching it have its identity crisis in which meme it's going to land on.
Yeah.
Did I go too far? You got it?
No, I think that's absolutely right. That's more or less what we've been talking about all morning.
That, all right.
There is explosion of possibilities that call into question the process of selecting possibilities and manifesting them. Right? So that's because human beings are a selection of possibilities and a manifestation of them. When that becomes exploded, human identity, human history, everything becomes exploded at the same time.
Yeah, and you're talking, what was the first part of what you were saying? I'm stuck on the idea that the memic is, that's a big part of the AP. People temporarily project into the meme and do something with it, and then mm-hmm. that disappears, and then the next meme shows up. But it's
right.
this ethereal nothingness of abstract ideas or memes, whatever they are, their images, the rapidity of thought, in a way,
mm-hmm.
that's going on. That's where people are being super violent today.
Sure. So, what you call these immaterial dynamic entities, that's the unconscious, right?
Yeah.
So human beings are faced with their unconscious in a way that calls human being into question.
It might even be beyond that. The question is gone, you've gone, and now you participate in the memic. Which is processing news. We keep thinking of disastrous chemical body outcomes of that, you know, nuclear war or plagues and stuff. And
mm-hmm.
That seems to be secondary. The battle and the Armageddon is in the realm of thought and meme and seeing how much you can engage in it. And
yeah,
most
so
people,
that goes back. That goes back to the Gigantomachia in the Sophist of Plato, right? It's the battle of the gods and the giants.
Yeah.
It's far beyond humans.
Yeah. Good point.
It's a battle that's autonomous between forces that are greater than us.
Yeah. Okay. So.
And you call that the Civil War of Media?
Yes. Well, McLuhan did. I quote him.
I parrot
him. But media and them are too solid now. They're old landscapes. It's the Civil War of thought. I mean, what? Just think of Julian Huxley and these guys in the 19th century that were starting saying we got to educate the worker, make the worker literate, and their whole education and night classes they started to get into to get people thinking. They thought, and then maybe in the 20th century people started to think more. They had more time. They weren't hassled by labor all the time. But no one saw that the thoughts would become a violent landscape of battle with the rapidity of turnover. Maybe that's what Finnegan's Wake is showing, though.
Maybe. You could think of the schools for Native Americans in those terms.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They were going to be taught how to think, which meant they were going to be ripped out of one type of thinking and put into another type,
right?
Or maybe put into another type, and now that that process has come home to roost.
Yeah,
the inherent war has become explicit.
But they are subject, like all cultures, to the mimic battle, the battle of thought, where culture
doesn't
get solidified.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think what you're calling mimic battle is nothing else but the unconscious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was another thing. The there's such a rapidity of thought, that's the environment, the ground, that or maybe percepts, that suddenly it shows up as an image that expresses it. Now we're conscious of it. That's the meme, the icon that starts sailing about. Then we're going to be unconscious. It will flip back into an unconscious, and then we wait for that meme to show up. But you go through this in a two-month period. You go through five unconsciouses of dropping into it and then dropping out of it. An amazing turnover of experience. It's not even experience. It's a very not now. It's not. Mm-hmm. There's no present to tune into. Other than the meme of the moment, but that disappears pretty quickly. So the violence of expression that's going on is pretty incredible. The violence of expression.
Notice the title, Take Today.
Yeah.
So in what you were just describing as the disappearance of the present is one reading of Take Today. But another reading of Take Today is recapture the present.
Yeah.
So the question is, how can the extreme violence and extreme dynamics of time into which we have been projected, how can human beings in that find what Pound called the unwobbling pivot? And McLuhan is represents one attempt to kind of achieve the required reorientation.
Exactly. And then we, my upstart lateral experience is to create something practical, as we discussed last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, the new hardware. Because it's software in extremis, the mimic world.
Correct.
But, you know, it's like, you know, we'll talk, maybe we won't talk next week. It's Thanksgiving. I don't know what will happen. But the, just think of the rapidity when we meet again of what will have passed through. There'll be a couple of, quote, fads or memes that have gotten attention and then dropped off. Then another one will come up. The rapidity of the turnover is amazing. So you go back to, is it page 31? Yeah. The rapid, he talks about the environments as the unconscious, the archetypes of the social unconscious. And a ersatz and environment is a rapid series of innovations. I think that's the phrase. Remember that? The ersatz and environment, it can't be in any environment anymore. Though we are trying to get talk ourselves into one, some kind of involved attachment, a rapid series of innovations is an ersatz and environment. So it's now a rapid series of memes is an ersatz. It gives the impression of an anti-environment, but it's ersatz. The name is staying power. Remember that quote? I've quoted it before. Yeah. So the turnover is amazing. So how to get a state of calm in the middle of that? That's the new Paramita Yoga. How do you do that? Where do you go to meditate? What do you meditate on?
Right. And who does it?
Who doesn't?
No, who does it?
Yeah.
Right? The captain has left the ship.
Okay. It's a rather depressing prospect there, Cameron. That was a joke. I don't get depressed.
Correct.
So, remember that Robin Williams movie? He was a poet. The Poet Society, I think it was called. He was a teacher.
And he was Dead Poet Society.
The what?
Dead poet.
Yeah. And the kids would say, "Oh, Captain, oh, Captain."
I don't think I saw the movie. I just know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that if I saw it again, do they deal with the captain disappearing? Probably not. And that's the Norwegian captain in Finnegan's Wake, or who's a variation probably on Earl Van Hoother, that the prank queen comes up. Now, here's something really secret. In McLuhan's copy of Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake, he's reading Joseph Campbell. That book is like one of the first attempts to explain Finnegan's Wake in detail in 1943 or so.
Yeah, very early.
Yeah, they had the time during World War II to do it. He says that Joseph Campbell doesn't understand the role of the prank queen, which is the role of the phonetic alphabet, I guess. I think that's what he says. So he probably would apply that to all the Joycean scholars who wrote books. They don't get the role of the prank queen. And so we come back to that quote. Why do I look like a posse of porter peas? Yes, Cameron, why do you look like that?
Well,
what did you do to yourself?
I must have lost my mind.
Okay. I think we're finished for today.
Yeah, good.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, it was another pretty interesting exploration.
Thank you. No, I began to see some things I didn't see before, so I appreciate that.
That's great. Okay.
Yeah.
Talk to you soon.
Good, Bob.
Okay, bye.
Thanks. Bye.